Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Today we begin the show by talking with you about basic university research and how, in this case, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, it resulted in cancer screening technology that saved millions of lives. We're talking today with a couple of guests who are intimately involved in this whole process. James Dahlberg is a UW-Madison Professor Emeritus of Biomolecular Chemistry. He played a very significant role in the development of diagnostic tests for many types of cancer. James Dahlberg, welcome. Thanks for joining in today.
Thanks, Larry. It's pleased to be here.
And, well, it's great to have you here. He's joined by his colleague, Brad Schwartz, a practicing physician scientist and the CEO of UW-Madison's Morgridge Institute for Research. And, Brad, thank you for joining in as well.
Thank you for having us, Larry.
As we talk with our two guests, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about how medical tests, life-saving medical tests, are made possible by research done on campuses like UW-Madison? Maybe you have some specific questions relating to the tests that we'll be talking about today. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. James, let's start with you. You had a remarkable decades-long career as a UW-Madison biochemist, later as an entrepreneur. Your research has led to the development of diagnostic tests for colorectal cancer, for cystic fibrosis, human papillomavirus, or HPV. How did you get along this path in your life?
Let me start off by saying that I had a very supportive wife, and she still supports me. without her, it wouldn't have been possible. But I've always been curious on how things work, and just if there's a question that I see, I'll sort of start investigating about it, what I can learn about it. I mean, now I'm an emeritus professor, so I don't have a lab or anything, so now it's more academic. I just read. I sit in my office and read the computer, but it's the discoveries that you referred to were done when I was a professor, active professor at the university in the biomolecular chemistry department. Even though the department is in the medical school, there's no requirement that we do a medically important research. It's just anything that we find is very important to us in terms of biology. And there was an experiment that didn't work the way it should. And as Brad likes to say, the main sound of discovery is, wow, I didn't expect that. And so we had a result that we couldn't explain, and so we decided we would follow up on that. And this was when we were investigating the structure of the genetic material that we all have, DNA. Mm-hmm. Different DNA molecules can take different shapes. We're normally exposed to the picture of DNA that looks like a long pencil, right? A mm-hmm. long string. But in fact, when DNA is actually functioning, it takes on different shapes. And we were interested in some of those other shapes. What we were trying to do was to make some of these shapes in the test tube and figure out what stabilize them, how they worked, and so forth. And by we synthesized them on a piece of paper. We wrote down what it should be, what we thought it should be, and tried to make the molecules in the test tube. And we were never successful in making them. And this is obviously very basic research.
Yeah.
There's no application whatsoever. But we finally found out, realized that even though we were unsuccessful in making these molecules, they were in fact being made. I'll cut to the chase here. They were being made, but the same enzyme that we were using to synthesize them also had the ability to degrade them. And so we were making things and chopping them up at the same time. And so this cleavage activity was what I was interested in. I said, this is something new, we'll see how is it working? How does it know to cleave this DNA molecule and not every DNA molecule in the cell? And so following that up, we discovered there's a certain structure that the enzyme is capable of cleaving. I also realized that I could make any molecule into that structure just by manipulating some other things that I was adding to the reaction. And I actually did have a eureka moment at that point. I remember I was sick in bed with the flu, staring at the ceiling. And then I realized that, hey, if I can make any molecule take this shape, and I have the enzyme that will cut the molecule when it does have that shape, it's a way of that I could cut any DNA molecule at any point that I place that I determine. And that was really the invention. And so I saw that this would be a very useful way of investigating DNAs in general. And I went to Wharf. I made a disclosure to Wharf, Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, that is the intellectual property agent for the University of Madison. I went to them and they said, yeah, it's worth patenting. It could have some utility. So they did. And so Wharf had the patent. And because of the Bayh-Dole Act, Wharf owned the patent, even though the research had been done at the university using federal funds, NIH funds. So once we had the patent, or we had applied for the patent at that time, I happened to be sitting next to a friend, Lloyd Smith, who's a chemistry professor here. And Lloyd and I were talking about what we're doing, Lloyd had just come on campus and had, prior to coming here, had worked with a good friend of his, Lance Fors, and decided that they would start a company. They wanted to do a company, and there was going to be analysis of DNA. But they still lacked some of the technology that was required. So Lloyd and I decided, why don't we try to get together? And so the three of us, Lloyd, Lance, and myself, started a company, Third Wave Technologies, which was based here in Madison. So at that point, we had no money. And we actually didn't have the patent because Wharf had the patent. Wharf had the intellectual property that was required for our company. So we had to negotiate with Wharf about how do we get our hands on this intellectual property so we could actually do something with this company that we had had. And at the time, the CEO of Wharf, Dick Laser, decided he'd take a chance with us. And this was the first time that Wharf had, or up to that point, Wharf had never licensed an invention back to the UW faculty member, the discoverer, inventor. And also they had never taken equity in a company, a startup company. But Dick Laser decided that he would take a chance and do both with us. And so it solved two problems for us. First of all, we didn't have to put a lot of money into it. we could just give Wharf some equity of just a piece of paper at that time.
Well,
we were off to the races after that.
Yeah. Wharf, we should mention, we should talk a little bit about Wharf, and maybe Brad, you can join in on this too, because there's certainly, you're with the Mortgage Institute, and there's quite a relationship between Wharf and the Mortgage Institute. And Wharf, I'm doing a little history in my head here. I think it was about 1925 when Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation was established, if I'm not mistaken. And I was trying to remember who was the instigator of it. Go ahead, Brad.
So that would be Harry Steenbach.
Oh, of course. Vitamin D.
That's right, who was the chair of biochemistry at the time. And it's a fascinating story, because in today's world, capitalizing on discoveries, the intellectual property from universities, is a hot topic. We hear a lot about companies being started on both of the coasts, and most people don't realize that the pathfinder for this was in the middle of the country at Wisconsin. So the story actually goes back to Harry Steenbach's graduate mentor, Babcock.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's the one that discovered or developed the butterfat test for quality of milk. He did not patent it. And at that time, the prevalent idea was that anything that was developed in universities was available for the whole society to use. The result was that a lot of charlatan operators came along and represented themselves as having the butterfat test and getting mm-hmm. farmers to pay them to do the test, and they never did it well and didn't give accurate results. So by the time Harry Steenbach isolated vitamin D and saw that it would prevent and cure rickets, he wanted to be able to put it out there for people to use, but he had seen how bad actors could misrepresent things. And so he wanted to patent it, so that the whole idea was to protect the integrity of the vitamin D. And so he went to the university, and again, this was a different time.
Sure.
And the university said, no, we don't do that. So he went to the state, and the state said, no, we don't do that. And so he got together with, I think, five or six of his friends, and they were all alums from the University of Wisconsin. And they all pitched in $100 each, and they formed the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, WARF. And the sole reason for WARF's existence was to patent discoveries that were made through research at the University of Wisconsin, with the goal of, number one, protecting the integrity of the discovery, and then number two, if any money were to come from licensing it, this money would go back to the university to help build future research enterprises.
It's an amazing story, and if I'm not mistaken, the amount of money that has been returned in the form of those patents back to Wharf and then back to the UW-Madison is somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 million.
I think that's probably true. It may even be north of $500 million.
Could be north. Yeah. It could well be north of $500 million.
It's a good investment for those $100.
$100 a piece.
That's right.
My guys.
You know, this is so fascinating that Wharf actually now has a full-time historian on staff. And that would be a recommendation for a future show.
That might make a good... and actually, in Wharf in turn... played a role in the development or the establishment of the Mortgage Research Institute, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
Yeah, so it was about 20, 08, maybe, in the late 20s. We had an investigator here, Jamie Thompson, who was thinking about leaving the university for a number of reasons. And one of them was that he had to have some sort of independent funding for his research, which was on human embryonic stem cells. And he went to Wharf and said, or somebody went to Wharf on his behalf and said that we need to keep Jamie here because of the research he's doing. And at that point, Wharf decided that it was really important to keep people, investigators such as Jamie, here on campus. So Wharf put up, I think it was $50 million, and the university put up $50 million, and John and Tasha Morgridge put up $50 million to get this started. And they decided they would have an institute that was affiliated with the university but independent of the university too. And as a result, a building was constructed, which is right in the middle of the campus, which is wonderful because there's a lot of collaboration and communication between Morgridge investigators and investigators on the UW side.
This is fascinating stuff here. As we talk information here, as we talk with our two guests today, James Dahlberg, UW-Madison Professor Emeritus of Biomolecular Chemistry, instrumental in bringing several types of health screenings, including colon cancer, an HPV, and another cystic fibrosis, which I even have my own little story about that. We may have time to get into it, but I know there are questions out there, and we have callers online with some questions, and we will get to those right after this. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. We're taking a look at visiting with a couple of folks from the University of Wisconsin. James Dahlberg, Professor Emeritus of Biomolecular Chemistry, and Brad Schwartz, practicing physician scientist, CEO of the Morgridge Institute for Research. And we're looking at some of the fantastic research that James and Brad as well have done. James has been very instrumental in several types of health screenings, including colon cancer and human papilloma virus for homes and hospitals, and of course, Cologuard as well. And looking for your comments or questions at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. And let's take a call. Bill in Cameron, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Bill. Bill, are you there? Oh, we may have lost Bill, or we can't hear him anyway. So instead, what we'll do is go to Richard in Manitowoc. Richard, hi.
Hey, I just got caught up in the Cologuard. Got one sent to me. Took the test and recently came back with a positive result. Now I'm left with a lot of anxiety and not knowing what's going to happen to me, what I'm supposed to do other than this colonoscopy, and is this just a big thing to get a lot of more business into the hospital to get colonoscopies, or should I take things seriously, and if so, what should I be doing to minimize any progress of the cancer while I'm waiting for my test.
Okay. Brad, let's go to you. Brad.
Okay, so this is something you should take seriously. The Cologuard test actually grew out of original curiosity-driven research that was done by a scientist named Bert Vogelstein at Johns Hopkins University. And he was studying how colon cancer begins and then how it evolves into something that spreads all over the body and ends up doing people in. And what he discovered was in its earliest stages, colon cancer starts out as just a little bump on the inside of the colon. And it has very specific molecular events inside of the cells in that bump. And if you can detect those molecular events, then you can say, whoa, colon cancer is starting in there. And the question is, how do you find it? And that's what the colonoscopy is for. So they look inside. And it turns out if you catch these little bumps at an early stage, they can use this instrument to just take the bump out. They don't have to do a great big surgery. They just remotely take this little bump out through the colonoscope, and they retrieve it and look at it under the microscope. And if you catch it early enough and they remove this bump, it is as if you never had it. So you get cured of colon cancer. And if you don't catch it at an early stage, then it progresses. It grows bigger. It grows a little more unruly. And it's the sort of thing that eventually gets so big that it can invade through the wall of the colon, and it can spread to other parts of your body. So this is an early warning that tells you there's something that is in there that should be found, and it should be taken out so that it doesn't progress. This is something to take very seriously.
And I'll tell you, Richard, based on my own experience, the last time that I had to go in for a colonoscopy, I had one of those removed, and I had no idea it was being renewed. I didn't have any resulting problems after the fact. And so the fact that you had the Cologuard, it showed the bump, and now you want to go and get it taken out, basically.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's, I guess, James, the value of the Cologuard in that sense is that if you have it and it shows nothing, then you don't, basically, you're not having to go through the colonoscopy.
Well, I think, I can't speak for Exact Sciences, the company that makes it. I think it's clear that it's a good screen. It's not 100% accurate, mm-hmm. but nothing is. But it certainly is a good indication that one should consult with one's physician and see what have a follow-up when there's a positive result.
All right. Richard, there you have it. That's the advice. And I'm not going to tell you to take that advice, but it's probably good advice to listen to. Let's put it that way. Bill and Cameron, we'll go to you. Hi, Bill.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to quickly call in and say my doctor really believes in the Cologuard test, and he's ordered it about 3 times, maybe 4 times in the last 10 years. The last time I did the Cologuard test was about 3 months ago, and it came back positive. So they ordered a colonoscopy. The colonoscopy showed one precancerous polyp. So the Cologuard picked up one polyp that was precancerous. So and now we're going to be watching that. They did remove it, of course, when they did the colonoscopy. But I just think that Cologuard test is a wonderful test, and was so beneficial that it picked up one polyp that was precancerous for me. So when I heard you introduce your show this morning, Larry, I thought, hey, this is right what I'm going through right now. So I really, really think that the Cologuard test is a great test.
Oh,
that's
well,
great.
Bill, thank you so much. I would guess that you guys get some response from people over time or even personally that sort of mirror what Bill was talking about.
Well, it certainly is a good feeling to hear people like Bill and others who say that they've taken action they would not have taken otherwise because of this test. So that it's very gratifying to hear that.
Yeah.
I'd just like to point out... I personally have not had a influence on making the Cologuard test. Mm-hmm. I had an assay that the people at Exact Sciences used after I retired. I mean, it's not my test. It's just that they used my technology. And it's very nice to see that the basic technology that I did many years ago is still being used and being useful for people.
Yeah.
I think that's an example of how successful applications use developments from lots of different fields. So you find something that works well, and it, as Jim says, it may not have been part of the founding technology for Exact Sciences, but they saw that the technology did exactly what they wanted, and it made their product better. And so these successful applications use the results of lots of different research activities to make their products better.
Yeah.
That's why curiosity-driven research is so important, because you never know where it's going to be useful. And you make a discovery and just put it out there, and somebody's going to come along and say, hey, I could use that, and it'll make my discovery that much better.
I remember, I'm thinking back here to Bill Proxmire.
Yes.
The Golden Fleece.
Who would have his Golden Fleece Award, and he might have caught a few, but sometimes those awards were based on basic research, and why the heck would anybody want to do that, Brad?
So Bill Proxmire had his Golden Fleece Award because it was good politics. He could say to his constituents, the federal government is using your tax dollars to do studies on why chickens get cancer from viruses. And that sounds really absurd, right? Well, the guy that was doing that research was a guy named Howard Temin. Mm-hmm. And Howard Temin ended up being awarded the Nobel Prize for that work. And that work gave the basic makings of the entire DNA technology revolution. So the majority of these miraculous new medicines that you see advertised on TV that have allowed lots of diseases to become treatable were all treatable because of the DNA technology revolution. And yet the question that drove Howard Temin was not, how can I develop a new technology? It was, everyone in the world says viruses don't cause cancer. So why is it that chickens do get cancer from this virus? And he was just unquenchably curious about that. And as Jim says, the thing about curiosity-driven research, I'll back up a little bit and I'll say that Tasha Morgridge always says the most effective kind of learning is curiosity-driven learning, which is true.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about, you know, the things that stick with you. And by the same token, the most effective kind of research is curiosity-driven research, because it's something that the researcher just has to know, just has to do. So if you discover something and it turns out to be true, at some time or another, that information will be valuable to somebody. You can't predict who it's going to be valuable to. You can't predict when it will be. But somebody will find a way to use it. So after Howard Temin discovered this enzyme that made recombinant DNA technology possible, it was somebody else who said, whoa, I can use that for some practical purpose, and transformed all of research and all of medicine.
Well, I was thinking back as you were talking, because I had many chances to talk with Howard Temin on this program, many delightful conversations with him. And James, I'm pretty sure you had many a conversation with him as well, perhaps.
Well, yes, Howard and I lived about a block apart and is about 4 miles from the campus, but he liked to walk into the lab every day, even on very snowy days, and so I joined him. And so we would have these long conversations where we walked along Monroe Street coming into the campus every day.
Probably stimulated both of your thinking.
Well, certainly, yeah. I certainly did a lot of research in the same field as a result of talking with Howard.
Yeah. John in Baronet has a question you may or may not be able to answer. Let's go there. Hey, John, thanks for calling.
You bet. Thank you, guys. Great show. My question is, I've been told that if you use the Cologuard test, send it in, no matter how it comes back, that Medicare, if you're on Medicare, and that's your only insurance, they will not pay for a regular colonoscopy for a year.
Boy, I don't know the answer to that. I think you'd probably have to talk to somebody at your doctor's office or your insurance company if you've got supplemental insurance. That's something I'm not certain of.
Yeah. I am not either. And darn, I wish I knew right off the top. Maybe somebody else can call in and that. But I think your advice, Brad, is good, to call either your whoever your insurance company is or your doctor, your own physician, family physician. I wish I could be more helpful on that. But that's probably the best advice. And you can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Brad, I just talk to you for a minute, too, because you're a practicing physician, and your focus of your research is on hematosis.
Or hematology, blood clotting, right?
Blood clotting, yeah. Talk about that. Why did you get in that?
Well, I actually started out to be a chemist, and so I had a very molecular approach, and I went into medicine because I wanted to teach at a university, and medical school faculties were just developing, and there were lots of career opportunities, so that's why I went into medicine. I had always focused on the molecular aspects of various things I was studying, and hematology really captured my imagination. And at the time, blood clotting was one area that probably had among the deepest molecular understanding of what was going on. And so I gravitated towards that. And I, to this day, find it fascinating. And I find that understanding the detailed molecular mechanisms of what some people may see as an arcane reaction in the body actually helps me understand a clinical situation much better, and mm-hmm. helps me make the judgment calls and sometimes the therapeutic decisions that would be more difficult without that deep of knowledge.
Really cool stuff. It's really cool stuff. Well, there, I want to tell you a little story. When I was 12 years old, I had a friend, David, in school. And he had a younger sister, and we were I'd see them both, and then suddenly I didn't see his sister around, and so I asked him, "Where's your sister?" And he said, "Well, she's sick. She has something they call, I think it's like cystic fibrosis." And that was a death sentence for her. And it wasn't long before I experienced the first time having a friend, someone I knew, die. Mm-hmm. So it was and you can imagine what it was like for the family. It affected me, but it certainly had a much larger effect. And some of your work James has a relationship, and by the way, that was a long time ago, and cystic fibrosis. Now, folks, it's still, it's a fatal disease, but as opposed to dying in a year or whatever, people live to be 50, 60 years old, even some into to 70. But the fact that this, you have you're in part responsible for a test for cystic fibrosis.
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, I mean, I developed the technology, but
yeah.
I'm not a clinician. So and it's very gratifying to know that the technology that I put out there is being used by others. And cystic fibrosis is just one example, I think. And, of course, the colon cancer is another example, and also HPV, the cervical cancer diagnosis that we have. We developed a third wave. But all of these things are very nice to hear about, but I'm glad that I was able to contribute to some of it. And it's the work of many, many people, not just me, of course, that is developing all these assays.
Yeah. Ray and Madison may have something about insurance-related answer for us. Ray, thank you for calling. Oh, darn. maybe we'll get him back. He's a surgeon and had some comments about he was listening and may have some comments. Ray, have we got him there yet? Oh, I think his phone may have died. Well, Ray, try again, because we'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, Jill or Jeff or somebody passed me along that there is a website that the caller can go to relating to insurance, and it's just, if you go to Cologuard.com/insurance, it'll go right to at least a broad, well, maybe a very specific comment relating to Medicare and Cologuard. Estella may also be able to talk with us about it in Sturgeon Bay. Stella, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah. My husband took there's 2 points I'd like to raise. My husband took the Cologuard test, and it came back indicating that he should get a colonoscopy. We're on Medicare, original Medicare, not Medicare Advantage. And he was scheduled for a colonoscopy as soon as we could, and Medicare covered both. So there was no problem at all with Medicare covering a colonoscopy following a Cologuard test, at least where it indicated that a colonoscopy was recommended for follow-up.
Well, Stella, thank you very much for calling, and you know what? That makes sense to me. Why wouldn't you have a test?
Yeah.
It wouldn't make any sense any other way. But I appreciate very much you calling in, Stella. Appreciate it. Talking with James Dahlberg and Brad Schwartz today from the University of Wisconsin. James, of course, emeritus professor of biomolecular chemistry, and Brad Schwartz, practicing physician, CEO of the Morgridge Institute for Research. I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us today as we talk about the research going on the UW-Madison campus that has led to a number of life-saving work by not only folks from the UW-Madison, but from probably around the world, with our guests today, James Dahlberg and Brad Schwartz from the UW. And Brad, you I know you wanted to make a comment about another comment about research, curiosity-driven research.
So, thank you. I think it's worth looking a little deeper at what that means. So, curiosity-driven research is a term that we use instead of saying basic research or applied research or translational research. And the reason is it's all curiosity-driven. And different people are curious about different things. And so, once again, what drives a good researcher is this unquenchable thirst to figure out how something works. So it may be somebody's curious about the basic mechanism of how something works. And once he or she figures that out, there may be somebody else that is curious about, what can I use this for?
Mm-hmm.
And then there may be somebody else who's curious about some disease that might benefit from using the thing that was developed. So it turns out that every step is really driven by curiosity. And I think it would be important for people to, number one, keep that in mind, and to not divide up research into basic research and applied research that are all arguing over resources. I think that research is sometimes seen as an arcane undertaking that most of us don't get any benefits from. And nothing could be further from the truth. You know, there are societal benefits. So we can take care of diseases that we couldn't take care of before. More people are living longer and happier. Every time there's a new development or treatment, oftentimes there's a new company that is formed, and that company ends up generating revenue. That company pays taxes to the state, pays taxes to the United States. We all get benefits from that. That company creates jobs. People come in, get good paying jobs that will last for a long time. But there are also more sort of direct advantages that each of us sees, because when we talk about research and coming up with new treatments, sometimes we think about rare diseases, and they're not always rare. So my favorite example of this is my brother-in-law's encounter with appendicitis. So it wasn't that long ago that if you had appendicitis, you'd have to have surgery, which would keep you in the hospital for 4 to 7 days, and you would be out from work for 3 to 6 weeks before you could go back, and you'd have to be very careful about your activity. So my brother-in-law developed appendicitis on a Wednesday evening. He went into the hospital. He had his surgery through laparoscopic intervention, which is sort of like a periscope when they look inside your abdomen. They took out his appendix. They did everything they needed to do. And he was back in the office at full speed on Friday. And that is something that happens now almost all the time. And I think appendicitis is so common that we see it as a regular thing. So it's not just the surgery. It's the CT scans that allow us to be very, very accurate about knowing when somebody needs surgery and who doesn't need surgery. And all of those things are the direct results of curiosity-driven research. So we all benefit from that.
I was thinking about my freshman year in college when the night before my first final of five final exams at the end of the semester, I had to go in and have my appendix out. So I missed all my exams and then had to take them the next semester while I was taking five more courses. I wish they'd had that laparoscopic version back then. So that's a very a very good one. Tom in Menominee, we'll get to you. Tom, thanks for calling.
Thank you. My question is in reference to the National Institute of Health and how your research is or was funded. Is that going to impact you in any way if they're going to have dramatic cuts to that program, or how does that work in reference to your research?
Go ahead, James.
Well, excuse me. In my own case, I've retired, so it's not going to affect me directly. But I have many colleagues who are very seriously affected by these cutbacks. Many of the cutbacks from the NIH and from NSF, both federal funds, funding agencies, many of the cutbacks seem quite arbitrary to us, and it's hard to discern just where there's a pattern. But when the cutbacks do occur, which are substantial, they can be very disruptive for a career, but also for the research that's being investigated. There are a number of cases that I know of where people have had spent years developing strains of cells or strains of animals or plants that they have to put on hold or just destroy because the funding is suddenly pulled out, like pulling the rug out from under you. And it's not as if you can stop it 1 week and then a week later turn it back on.
Yeah.
It's going to set research back very significantly. The cuts that we're already seeing and the ones that are being sort of on the horizon. So I think this is a very serious problem for the scientific community, not only in the U.S., but throughout the world, because we impact, our research is impactful throughout the world through collaborations.
Yeah. And Brad, I know you want to... Yeah.
So I want to second that very loudly. And point out that this is the kind of research that companies will not pick up because the research in the early phases of figuring out how something works has no immediate application, and companies are doing what they're doing to make a profit. And if there's not a likelihood that they'll be able to turn something towards a profit in a reasonable period of time, they won't do it. And as a matter of fact, if you go back over the past number of years and look at instances when federal funding for research was under threat, it's easy to dig up, to come upon advertisements that were taken up by groups of companies saying, this research is important to us, we can't do it, but we depend upon what university researchers do to give us the things that we need that we can develop products from. So the other aspect is if a university research lab has to close because there is not sufficient funding to support their work, the very skilled researchers that work there are sort of cast to the wind, and there's not an easy way for them to be able to get a job that takes advantage of their expertise and their experience. Now, they're smart people. They're good at what they do. They usually find something else. But if funding comes back online, you don't have a ready workforce that has that deep expertise and experience that is ready to step in and get things going again. It's usually a long startup period. Funding comes back online.
It's just a terrific waste of money, basically, and skills.
Yeah, and skills. Well, and in the meantime, you guys, let's hope that we can get some resolution on some of this. And in the meantime, I want to thank you both for the work that you've done and continue to do. I appreciate it very much. And hopefully, maybe we can have a chance to talk about this again down the road. I think it was really interesting. I'm sorry we didn't get to all the calls. But there you have it. James, Brad, thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll look forward to another chance to talk with you.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
James Dahlberg is UW-Madison Professor Emeritus of Biomolecular Chemistry, instrumental in bringing several types of health screenings to the marketplace, including colon cancer, HPV, and cystic fibrosis, among others. Fun to have and interesting to have them with us, and thank you for listening in. Coming up, we're going to switch gears entirely. It's the county fair season. We'll be talking about judging at the fairs next. I'm Larry Mealer.